Good morning. You're listening to 91.5 KUNV, and this is Neon Eden. I'm your host, Tovin LaPan, reporter for the Las Vegas Sun. My co-host, as always, is Sun political reporter Andrew Doman.
Good morning.
It's the holiday season and the end of the year, and now is the time when many people start to think about charitable donations. But how do you make sure your money is going to an organization that is going to make the most of your donation? Later in the show, we'll have Sun business reporter Eli Siegel in the studio to discuss charity financials. But first, we take a look at the most connected nonprofits in the region. The Lindsay Institute at UNLV recently published a report on the most on the nonprofits with the greatest networks, the organizations that are stretching their funding the furthest by collaborating with others to pool resources and apply for grants. Joining us today to discuss the report is Robert Lang, UNLV Director of Brookings Mountain West. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So you commissioned this study about nonprofits and, their connections in the Las Vegas Valley. And why did you want to know who was popular?
Well, for the purposes that you identified earlier, which is that it's very critical for nonprofits to have partners. They can't take on the world's problems all on their own. They have limited resources. And so part of this is that a funder of the Lindsay Institute, our funder, requested pretty early that we do a comprehensive review of the nonprofit sector in general in the region, and part of that was like, what's the landscape look like? And that landscape includes who's partnering with, with each other.
Mm-hmm. And what goes into making, say, not necessarily good or bad nonprofits, but I guess efficient nonprofits? What goes into, say, making the most of those charitable donations? Where are things where, what are they spending their money on, which may be things other than their actual stated goal of, say, feeding the hungry?
Right, and mentioning that includes, for example, Three Square, which is a great example of an organization that mostly spends its money on getting food, and then its organization is pretty light in terms of management, and it's light in part because they have so many partners who help with distribution. So you then engage the Clark County schools, and you have volunteers and so on, and a lot of the distribution burden is either a paid employee of the county or somebody who's volunteering, and thus you leverage more of your resources on what you say you're interested in doing, which is feeding people.
More of your donation then would go to actually buying food.
Yeah, if you give a dollar to them, 90 plus cents is going to get to buying food. Mm-hmm. And you want to hear that. An organization that didn't have as robust a network for distribution might have 60 or 70% going to food because it would be a burden. It's not to say it's not an unworthy contribution. It's that nonprofits especially have to show that they've leveraged their efforts. And leveraging means partnership. And what this study shows is the contours of those partners.
So
who's partnered to who?
If I wanted to give money, you mentioned that one of the donors from the Lindsay Institute was very interested to know basically who is most connected. It's maybe coined a new word there.
Yeah, I like that one. But it's a holiday word.
Is it best, though, to give to who's most popular?
It's not. I wouldn't say it's best to give who's most popular. I think it's best to give to who's most efficient, who's well embedded in community in a way that they're more effective as a result of those connections. And so, this isn't a popularity contest. This is among organizations. And if you're an isolate, you just don't get as much done.
What's an isolate?
Well, we predict. The model is sort of it's a network model. It's a network system model. I don't want to get any of the methods on the morning show like this. But I'll say, in essence, you ask another organization, hey, who do you partner with? You don't ask the organization itself, who are your partners? You ask everybody else who they're partnering with, and if they identify you in these multiple ways they can. Do you go for grants together? Or you serve on each other's boards? Have you run events together and so on? Have you talked to each other in the last week? When you put that all together, you then predict where somebody will wind up, and some organizations are so big they better be at the top. United Way is called United Way for a reason. It's united, it's got a lot of resources, it's at the top. There are other organizations that didn't do as well, even though they have a lot of resources. For example, Co-op Extension, Cooperate, is a complete isolate, basically, despite the fact that it was founded in the 1950s. It has millions of dollars in budget. It has 50 or 70 employees down here, depending on how you calculate it. And it has virtually no connectivity. So it was predicted to be in the top 10 in terms of connectivity, and it wound up at 266.
So no one wrote them down, basically, as a partner.
Right. No one is partnering with them in the areas of health, social service, and education. And those three areas are the heart of urban extension. They do 4-H as well. But mostly in Clark County, it's not like we've got a giant ag sector. you know, mostly in Clark County. There's gardening, of course, but mostly it's about, you know, women's issues and health. It's about children and so on. And in those areas, you would have expected to see a lot more connectivity to that organization, to Co-op Extension, and there's virtually none.
So that's at the bottom of the scale. UNLV's at the top, right? They turned out to be sort of the homecoming queen in this case. People wrote them down.
Yeah, and what it is organizations like Lindsay and the Women's Center and the Children's Center are in these sectors very heavily and are partnering, and I can see it in even in my own work. I mean, we really are, you know, our Rolodex is full and there isn't a day go by where we're not engaged with partners. And that's not uncommon for a big university. It's that we weren't actually charged. We don't have the resources to do extension. We don't get the money from the state to do extension. UNLV is, in effect, doing extension. And I can show you, you know, comprehensively how much more engaged this university is than is the UNR co-op extension. It makes sense. They're several hundred miles away. It's really hard to phone in this form of extension. Ag's a little easier, but, you know, this is a heavily networked kind of extension. And if you're not in the home county, it's more difficult to do, which is why in a lot of states they've delegated these sectors of outreach to whatever the branch of the state university is there.
And so, well, you mentioned Three Square, which is obviously our Southern Nevada food bank, and then UNLV. What are some of the other ones that ended up at the
Catholic
top?
Charities, the United Way, you know. The group at the top, again, are, you know, some of it's predictable. In the case of Three Square, it's a newer organization with a pretty light staff, so it was an outlier in a positive sense. Mm-hmm. You know, it's who you think typically would be there. Opportunity Village, for example, is heavily partnered. Again, longstanding commitment in the community, longstanding, you know, pretty good sized staff, decent resources, and well applied, I'd say.
You know, one of the things, though, that I found surprising about the study was seeing how almost half of the nonprofits are less than a dozen years old. It seems like we have a really young, maybe immature nonprofit sector.
We do, and we have a lot of several characteristics of it. A, there's high turnover because nonprofit organizations have a shorter duration typically than for-profit. It's a, you know, maybe a restaurant. There's a few areas of for-profit that are more volatile, but nonprofits are often quite ephemeral. The other thing is it's a newer region, and even if you look back a dozen or so years, you're talking about hundreds of thousands of less people to provide service. Also, it's a point where government services are contracting, so the demand on the private side is increasing. So there's a lot of market niche. And then finally, and a report's going to come out next month that shows, we don't do that well with the state, and that the nonprofits in the north are mostly on hard money, and ours are on philanthropy.
What's hard money?
It means if the state has resources to dedicate to children or to health issues, you're literally a recipient of either federal pass-through money or the state-derived money through taxation, you know, through the general fund. And if they're investing in you directly with that money, it's a more secure source than philanthropy. Thus, the nonprofit salaries are higher in the north than the south, despite the fact that regional incomes are higher here generally than they are in Reno, because they're on that more secure source. So we've had to substitute much more private sector response because we are not only not in a great relationship with Washington, D.C. in areas like health and education and social services, we're not in a great relationship with Carson City in those as well.
So we're young, there's a lot of turnover, we're not getting a lot of help from the state capital or the nation's capital. It sounds like there's some issues here that need to be worked out in the nonprofit sector.
We need to take care of ourselves because we're orphans. Quite frankly, we're orphans. We're orphans of Washington because the state is 53rd out of 53rd on what is called formula aid, but it's really everything you'd know from housing aid to, you know, to transportation. And then we are the weakest in terms of our access to the state capital on per-person expenditures. And I mean, it's dramatically lower. And we have a piece coming out on that in January. We don't want to have Mountain Christmas because it might scare the children. And they are tough. They are tough because they are honest.
So how do we improve those things? How can the nonprofits here get more federal aid and start there? How do we improve the money we're getting?
Well, for starts, we as a habit, we haven't been through the public sector reaching to D.C. for resources, which is why we're behind Guam and the Virgin Islands. And this is not Harry Reid. This is not our congressional delegation. This has a lot to do with just the competency of the state and the matching funds from the state. So in a lot of areas of medicine, if you don't match, you don't get. Then when we were cutting our budgets, in other states, and I've talked to consultants like Moody's who advise states on budgets and budgetary issues, they were looking at their budgets in 2009 and 2010 and saying, if we cut this program, we lose the federal match. So let's save that program. So juvenile diabetes stays. Adult diabetes, you're on your own, kids. You know, you're on your own adults. We got to take care of the kids. So they strategically went through with a scalpel. We went through with a hatchet. And in the process, forfeited a lot of that resource.
So we've done some stuff to hurt ourselves, maybe in Nevada. But have we done enough to help ourselves? And by that, I mean, in the report, the author looks at some of the issues going on with nonprofits and finds that a lot of them are saying to her via some questionnaires in the study that a lot of nonprofits aren't using data to measure outcomes. They don't have technical expertise to apply for grants. Is there some stuff, just some basic stuff we could do here on our own with that?
Yeah, and I think that's, you know, the part of what the Lindsay Institute is doing is offering technical assistance in those areas. Part of what the other big anchor nonprofits can do is offer technical assistance in those areas. It's tough to get the staff to fill out the paperwork. The state has to participate in that as well. Typically, states are partners in helping nonprofits and helping the private nonprofits get federal money. And so when you're anemic at the state level and the state isn't getting its fair share, you can imagine that by extension that means that nonprofits are also disadvantaged. But some of this is that we need to organize around, you know, a few key plays, a few key asks of, you know, where we put our resources together. And it's tough because, you know, organizations are like people. Some get along, some don't. A couple of key players disagree on, you know, a major issue or two, and they're not talking anymore. And so, you know, that's the part of the network analysis that is like high school. So right. You need to put some of those differences aside and do it for the better, you know, for the better outcomes in the community as a whole.
That was one of the things in the study that another person who was polled and who is in the nonprofit sector said that there's this cutthroat. I think that was the quote, cutthroat atmosphere of competition. When dollars are scarce, they all compete with each other rather than collaborating.
Yeah, and it's issue by issue, too. You know, my issue is more important. You know, I've set up a nonprofit to tackle it, so I'm committed to this issue. Or you're in the same sector, and we think we have a better way of, you know, of relieving this problem. So, yeah, it's a lot of personality. But again, you know, the bigger stake here is that cooperation tends to produce better outcomes. This is true even, you know, when you look at how municipalities approach, you know, state capitals, if they come together, how they approach Washington, if the state has its act together. The problem historically in Nevada has been very scarce resources, a very small public sector, and then a lot of competition among private interests for very scarce dollars. And then a problem north-south, which is, you know, I bet it's friendlier in the north because there's a lot less fight over a lot more resource than there is in the south. And I say that not speculatively, but I say that based on numbers.
And you mentioned the co-op extension. What are the other sort of least connected nonprofits in the region?
Well, most of the least connected are fairly small organizations. So there's not a lot of big organizations that kind of crept out in that regard, if you will. So, you know, the reason we raised Co-op Extension is it's a large and well-funded, well-resourced, large-staffed organization to have not connected was notable. So there are smaller nonprofits that still underperform even for being small, but the difference between where they're predicted and where they outcome is not as great. So it's the model shows, especially, and this is good, for mid-range or, you know, what would have been near top-tier performers like a Three Square to show that how essential Three Square is, how well-connected it is, how much to predicted model a place like United Way is or Catholic Charities or an old organization, you know, such as Opportunity Village, that it's good to see that what should have been the anchor institutions are doing anchoring. A lot of the nonprofit community sort of gravitates around that core of organizations, including the university.
So you mentioned a few times here that in northern Nevada, I get the sense that there's a very different kind of network going on up there that would look maybe different from the one that was measured here.
Yeah, it would be a lot. The government agencies would be at the center of it. And the difference is this, that the north's nonprofit sector is older because the north is older. The north was larger in the early part of the 20th century. And even through the mid to later part of the 20th century was at parity with Las Vegas. So Las Vegas is so newly large a region. It's the newest large metropolitan area, along with places like Orlando, say. And it, you know, it was one of the few that wasn't really predicted to be at the scale it's at. And as a result, the maturity in the North means that the networks back to the government, that the sort of the lines back to Carson City, the proximity to Carson City, advantage the North nonprofits and give them a little bit less of a concern for always going out and working philanthropy. Now, the interesting thing is we have a report coming out that shows that there is more philanthropy South, not just overall, per person. So the South actually is more giving. But the South is depleted because the giving is not leveraged off nearly the amount of public resource that the North has. And that's the difference, that the organizations up there can then be more stable, a little bit less cutthroat, a little bit less competitive with one another. They have maybe longer histories with each other because they've had maybe decades of engagement, say, because of the age of the region. All of that's more helpful in terms of addressing problems up North. So all kinds of health outcomes, all kinds of public policy outcomes work out better up North. The North is healthier than the South. That's hard to predict because mostly the bigger the region, the more medical service, the greater the scale of medicine, the lower morbidity and so on. So an outlier is Las Vegas, where a much smaller region seems to have better outcomes than us.
It seems like you're kind of just saying that we've grown so fast, we're still settling in and figuring out what we want to do. But you just said that in the South, people in the Las Vegas Valley give more on a per-person basis. Why?
Part of it is they have to. Part of it is that without it, there would really be a much greater level of distress, for example. So the private sector is making up for part of the deficit in the public sector, which is larger here than it is in the North. The other thing is that there's just more wealth in the South. And there's wealthy corporations. For example, there's only four Fortune 500 companies in the state. All of them are in gaming, and they're all Southern headquartered. There is nothing up North of comparable size. And so the sort of the deeper wealth, if you will, is in the South.
It kind of surprises me, though, because we have such high unemployment in the South, and of course, the housing crisis compounding that, so many homes underwater. Who's actually doing the giving? Is it mainly, you know, a few rich people, and then it gets averaged out on a per capita basis, it comes out higher?
No, it's pretty broad. And remember, you know, despite high unemployment, there is relatively high salaries in the South because of especially unionization in the key sector. The biggest sector is obviously tourism. And in that sector, a large share of the workforce are unionized, and they have relatively good benefits, and they have relatively high resources, and they're quite charitable. So I wouldn't say that it's all just that there's a few key players that are wealthy and they've given to everything, although certainly that there's been a disproportionate share of that investment by people who are well-to-do. But there's also just a lot of rank-and-file folks out there that have, you know, moderate resources, although pretty stable resources, and they've been pretty strong givers.
So a bartender, a card dealer, someone at a casino.
Yes,
and decent money.
And the culinary is set up to do that, too. You know, it's a big partner in terms of this philanthropy. And so the union itself recognizes responsibility, social responsibility to the region, which is good. You'd hope that to be the case. And so luckily, the charity, the generosity of Southern Nevada has been sufficient to substitute for a substantial amount of difference in the North and South in terms of public investment. But I'd say going forward that Southern legislators ought to say, hey, how about we get the same share of that money spent on our problems, and then our public sector could even be leveraged further.
Right, and it seems like many things, it goes back to that North-South divide in Nevada in terms of the resources spent. Well, thanks for joining us. We've been speaking with Robert Lang, UNLV Director of Brookings Mountain West. The Lindsay Institute of UNLV recently published a report on the most connected nonprofits in the region. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Hey, you're listening to Neon Eden on 91.5 KUNV. Joining us now in the studio is Sun business reporter Eli Siegel. Thanks for joining us.
No problem. Hi, Tobin.
All right, back in August, Eli wrote about charities and nonprofits in Las Vegas and sort of what their financials are and how they're spending their money. And first of all, Eli, what goes into sort of, I guess, a well-managed charity? Where are some of the areas that they spend their money that aren't sort of their stated goal, where you have to make sure they're maybe not not doing things if inefficiently.
Yeah. Well, I guess overall, you know, what we did was we looked at 10 of the largest, most well-known charities in Vegas, and then each nonprofit group is required by federal law to require to file what's called a 990. It's just a tax return. It's publicly available. So we looked through the most recent 990s, and what we found is that, you know, for the most part, they all spend their money on the right places. So about 80% of their spending goes to programming, and which is a really broad category, and it actually includes salaries. And it includes, you know, if you're, you know, if you're paid $100,000 a year and you spend 80% of your time on programming and 20% on administrative work, that 80% counts toward programming. So a lot of them are spending most of their money on programming. You know, they're spending, you know, relatively little on administration and a little bit more, but not too much on fundraising expenses. So the key for these nonprofit groups and for any nonprofit is to keep your money, as they say, keep your money focused on your mission. So spend it on programming, whether it's paying people to run programs, because I think a lot of people think that programming is you have to buy stuff, you know, you're buying food or you're buying clothes, but a lot of nonprofit groups provide services, and it might be legal help, or it might be, you know, foreclosure assistance counseling or something like that. So you're not buying physical goods, but you are paying people to do that work. And so that does count toward your programming. So as long as you keep putting your money toward that, I think that's a healthy thing.
So the programming is basically the thing you're known for. If you're the programming would be providing legal services. If you're helping, if you purport to help disabled veterans, that the programming would be the actual services,
right?
And time rendered.
Yep, exactly. It's you know, the people they hire to help people in need, and it's their salaries or if you take a food bank, for example, their programming obviously is providing food. So they have kitchen expenses, they have to pay their workers, they have to buy food, they have to do all those kinds of things. So all that counts toward programming.
If I've got $100 in my pocket that I want to give during this holiday season, what's a good way? Is that the best way for me to know really that my money is getting stretched to its, you know, greatest extent? It's being used well.
Yeah, this is probably the closest gauge that you can get. There's really no exact science, and unless you're a big donor and you're setting up some kind of endowment or some kind of foundation, you really don't have a lot of say. Actually, no, I take that back. I think you can earmark where your money goes, but to make sure that it gets spent in the right place, you know, you can look at these numbers, and this is really the closest thing you can get. It's tough to say like my money is going directly to that, but this at least can give you a guide on which groups are spending their money on how. So. Mm-hmm.
And one issue raised earlier this year by Tampa Tribune and Center for Investigative Reporting story was on charities and how they raise their money and using outside companies to raise their money. And what's the issue there? Is it just that they're spending too much? Some of those charities raised in the report were spending too much money, or is it how they're raising the money itself?
I think it was both, if I can recall correctly. And what they did was they looked at hundreds, if not thousands, of nonprofit groups around the country and looked at how much money, like you said, how much money they were spending on fundraising costs. And a lot of that money, there's a line item in these tax returns, and it's called like professional fundraising fees or something like that. And basically what it means is you're, for the most part, you're hiring a call center to just do automated, not robocalling, but like, you know, high volume phone calls to raise money for a particular charity. And those groups are for-profit call centers. And the thing is, what the Tampa paper found was that a lot of those call centers have direct connections to the nonprofits that are paying them. Like, they might have relatives who, you know, you've got one guy on the board at a nonprofit group and his brother owns the call center that he's paying to do. So it was a lot of murky stuff, a lot of conflicts of interest and things like that. They did not find any nonprofits in Nevada actually that do this. They did find a couple of call centers that were being in Nevada that were being paid by these nonprofits, but I think they were actually in Northern Nevada. I don't even think they were in Vegas. But yeah, so that was the issue. And for the 10 groups that I looked at, and there are a whole lot more in Vegas, so this was not a comprehensive look by any means, but for the 10 groups that I looked at...
What are those 10 groups, by the way?
Sure. The 10 groups were, we looked at Three Square.
The food bank.
Yep, food bank. United Way of Southern Nevada. Opportunity Village, which is a job training program. Goodwill of Southern Nevada. Obviously, you know, the well-known retail stores. Catholic Charities of Southern Nevada. Help of Southern Nevada, which provides substance abuse treatment, job training, housing assistance to the homeless, stuff like that. Safe Nest, Boys and Girls Clubs of Las Vegas, Habitat for Humanity Las Vegas, and Spread the Word Nevada, which is gives free books to low-income children. So those are the 10 groups. Basically, I think only two of them actually spent money on professional fundraising fees, and it was a very little amount. Most of them just do their fundraising in-house. They don't pay any outside groups to do it. And they do have to spend money on fundraising because these groups are nonprofits. That's how they survive. So it's hard to knock them for actually doing fundraising work. But I think where what the Tampa report found and where a lot of these groups get into trouble is when they're spending a lot of money on professional fundraising fees and they're really not making much of a profit off of it. Plus, you know, there are all these conflicts of interest. But again, none of those groups were in Nevada. So,
you know, a lot of the nonprofits you just named are pretty well known. I mean, people in the community know that at least this group is a legitimate group. But for some of the, you know, earlier in the program we had on Robert Lang from the Brookings Institute, who looked at 400 nonprofits. So for some of these that are less well known, how can people who maybe want to give this holiday season know that they're actually giving to a nonprofit?
It's a good question. There is a lot of nonprofit fraud out there. That is a major issue. One of the things you can do is you can verify their nonprofit status. That's one step, and you can do that by going to the Internal Revenue Service website, and you can check if they are, in fact, registered as a nonprofit with the IRS.
You can just type in their name.
Yeah, there's a database online at irs.gov, and you can search, and you can check the status of their nonprofit status. A lot of times, nonprofits get their status revoked because they don't file their 990s, the tax returns. They don't file them on time. They don't pay necessary fees to the IRS. So there are hundreds of small, you know, totally unknown nonprofits, like a lot of little league organizations, a lot of stuff like that, that they're not household names, but that get their nonprofit status revoked. So if you get solicited by a group that says we're a nonprofit, we help the kids, so-and-so, and you've never heard of them, a good step would be to go to the IRS, check their nonprofit status, and then also you can go to a website, which is totally free to download the information. It's called GuideStar.org, and you can search for the most recent 990s and verify whether they are filing their tax returns, and you can inspect their balance sheet and financial data and stuff like that. So that's another way to verify. You can ask around. You can look online, see if anything's been written about this group. If there's nothing out there on them, you know, it's good reason to be suspicious then. Yeah. Because there is a lot of fraud.
And the 10 charities you looked at, I mean, overall, how did those 10 do in terms of managing their finances, both in terms of balancing their books, but also just, you know, accomplishing their objectives?
Yeah, in terms of balancing their finances, not very well. Right. Because seven of them, for the most recent years that we looked at, finished the year in the red. So they're spending the money in the right place, but they're still losing money. And as a nonprofit, and a nonprofit is still a business. You still have to have, you know, your expenses still have to be lower than what you're bringing in order to survive and stay afloat and be able to hire people and to provide more services. You still have to run it as a business. You just can't distribute the profits to people as a nonprofit. So, but you still have to make money. And a lot of these charities are not. And so a lot of it has to do with the recession. They have seen their government grants absolutely plunge. They're getting fewer donations from people. A lot of locals are cutting back. You know, Las Vegas isn't known as a big source of nonprofit donors anyways. There are a lot of, you know, very charitable people here, but overall it has a reputation for not being a very giving place. So they're getting a lot fewer donations. So financially, a lot of these groups are still struggling. Hmm. And it'll probably take a while before they can be, you know, really healthy again.
Well, all right. Well, at least they're doing a good job. It seems like we have a lot of good charities that are worthy of your donations, and they are in need. So it's something to keep in mind as the holidays approach. We've been speaking with Las Vegas Sun business reporter Eli Siegel. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
And you've been listening to Neon Eden on 91.5 KUNV. Our producer is Richard Riegel. My co-host is Andrew Doman, and I'm Tovin LePan. See you next week.